Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
State lawmakers have found initial success pushing legislation to allow concealed weapons on college campuses, but some students vow to oppose the measure to the bitter end.
It's going to be harder for them to look students in the eyes and say, we still want to, you know, put concealed carry on your campuses.
Also this week, going to the doctor? A new report says you may have more and more trouble finding one.
We face a 107% shortfall. And anesthesiologists and general surgeons.
We'll also learn the latest on making Florida's local government pensions more solvent, efforts to keep racing greyhounds healthier, and we'll go searching for an historic old World War II airfield. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Despite broad opposition on Florida's campuses, state lawmakers are moving forward with a plan to allow guns on university campuses. 3 months ago today, there was a shooting at Florida State University, and as Nick Evans reports, this week the controversial measure began its path through the state Senate.
Last November, Florida State University students woke to find there had been a shooting at the school's main library. Three were injured, and one of them is now paralyzed from the waist down. The shooter was killed by police. In the morning, an impromptu gathering of students formed on Landis Green, the long quad stretching out in front of Strozier Library. Some groups huddled in circles to pray together. At one point, two girls led students in the hymn to the Garnet and the Gold. But the prevailing atmosphere was shocked silence. Bundled in a heavy black coat, student body president Stefano Cavallaro tried to make sense of what had just happened.
It's scary stuff, you know, when things like this happen. It kind of shows, our vulnerabilities.
But even so, he was optimistic.
I think the student body's definitely mourning right now and very conscious about, just such an egregious act of violence on our campus. But I think that, we'll come out stronger from this.
Now 3 months later, the broken glass has been replaced and the chatter of students going about their day has returned. But they haven't forgotten the shooting. And a plan in the legislature to allow concealed weapons on campus leaves some students uneasy.
Well, for me personally, I would be more scared. I wouldn't feel comfortable. There was a shooting here at this library, and then, somebody could get angry or upset, and that could happen again.
That's Michelle Morrison. Another student, Reed Paul Johnson, agrees.
I would just feel a lot less safe walking around if I knew that people had guns on them, honestly. They may not use it, but I don't know, just the potential that it could go off or something scares me.
But just as many students feel like Emily Pingleton.
I support the bill. Okay. I believe that students have a right to carry guns on campus if it means more protection for them.
And so far, legislators are making progress.
Seeing no further debate, I would say that there's 9 other states that allows for concealed carry on college campus. And I think we need to make Florida the 10th state.
Senator Greg Evers is a Republican from Baker, and he chairs the Senate Criminal Justice Committee. He's a broad-shouldered, imposing man with a slow drawl. He keeps a soft black leather Bible on his desk, and there's a sign from the National Rifle Association over his office door. It reads, "An armed man is a citizen, an unarmed man is a subject." Evers is shepherding the bill through the Senate, and it came before his committee Monday. Shortly before the meeting began, the sergeant-at-arms had to start turning people away. Attendees stood lined against the back wall for most of the two-hour hearing. So many of them wanted to speak, in fact, Evers ended up cutting public comment short.
My name is Brandon Johnson. I'm a senator at FAMU SGA, and I'm the vice president for the State of Florida Youth and College Division for the NAACP.
Johnson was one of the students in attendance that didn't get a chance to speak.
So now, me being a college student, I'm frightened that my roommate next year, who could be very well be 21 or 22, who takes the course, who has a concealed license permit, could be having a gun next door. Or if I'm in a double, right across the with away from me.
Speaking in front of Strozier Library, Jade Reindl, an FSU student associated with Generation Progress's gun violence prevention team, explains that while the proposal is simple, that also means its effects are far-reaching.
While it does require a concealed carry permit, there are no regulations for the university, so the university wouldn't know, like, there's no registration system, so the university wouldn't know, like, oh, X, Y, and Z, this number of people in this dorm have guns.
Currently, public universities are on a list of places where concealed weapons are prohibited. The measure Evers is sponsoring in the Senate removes that language. But many states that allow concealed weapons on campus generally also let the school set aside limited areas like classes or dorms where guns aren't allowed. But Evers doesn't think Florida should have those restrictions.
At this point, I wouldn't be supportive of anything other than what we have right now.
In Utah, students living in dorms can request to be paired with roommates who don't have a concealed weapons permit. Evers says he wouldn't oppose something similar in Florida under one condition.
As it was voluntary, yes. But to inquire about a person having a concealed carry, that's a privacy issue, and I say no.
Evers moved the measure through his committee, but on a party-line vote. With both chambers under Republican control, that might not sink the proposal. But as the bill moves forward, the critics will likely grow louder. And it's not clear if a majority of state lawmakers, much less an embattled governor, want to put their name to such a controversial move. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A sea of geriatrics, manicured golf courses as far as the eye can see, beaches and theme parks. Florida should be a magnet for MDs just getting their start. But as Jim Ash reports, a shortage of residency programs has the state's medical school graduates streaming north most for good.
Wearing a crisp white lab coat at a recent Capitol press conference, Katie Alonso was trotted out as an example why Florida will be 7,000 doctors shy by 2025. A 2012 Florida State University medical school grad, she's headed to North Carolina for a thoracic and emergency care fellowship. After that, she doesn't know.
We'll see. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. It's a great opportunity. And again, you know, I'll be there for 3 years, so we'll see if I end up back in Florida.
Hospital executives are pointing to an exhaustive study predicting the doctor shortage and pleading with the legislature for more funding. They blame a lack of residency slots. Residents put down roots and stay anchored to their community, and Florida's 3,800 residents don't create enough anchors, the executives say. They want 14,000 by 2025. Rural areas make up a healthy chunk of Republican Representative Matt Hudson's Naples district, and his constituents take a beating when it comes to doctor availability. He says they'll cringe when they read the study.
They're not going to be thrilled that we face a 107% shortfall in anesthesiologists and general surgeons. Now, that's a scary number.
Outside of the study, numbers are hard to come by. Hospital groups refuse to name a price tag for the slots they want. They say the study should soak into the capital consciousness first. Tim Goldfarb, an executive with Shands Healthcare, says too much is at stake to play politics.
The decisions that are made in our Senate and in our House will impact the citizens for the next 10, 15, and 20 years.
Governor Rick Scott wants to spend $7 million on top of the $80 million the state dedicates to the programs. Senate Health Policy Chairman Aaron Bean of Jacksonville, a Republican, refuses to say whether his chamber will come in lower or higher. Bean blames Congress for the predicament. The feds pay for most residency slots, and states pay for any new ones on top of that. The Balanced Budget Act of 1997 froze the assigned slots it would fund. That was long before Florida had a mini medical school building boom, and long before Florida's population crept past New York to become the third largest state.
So it literally takes an act of Congress that's going to have to reassign and rebalance the residency. So right now, Massachusetts and New York are residency rich, even though their populations have plummeted.
Florida Hospital estimated in 2012 that the average cost of a residency program was $145,000. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers are digging into several ideas that could lead to helping people with mental illnesses who are also prone to getting arrested.
And this is not a 9-to-5 disease. You know, it still stuns me that it's okay to discharge people with serious mental illnesses into homelessness. And that's basically what we do.
A bill aimed at keeping tabs on racing greyhound injuries is on the fast track, but some argue it won't protect the dogs.
We know what's causing these deaths, and we know what's causing the injuries.
Florida's cities are backing away from a deal they agreed to last year to revamp local pensions, and lawmakers aren't having it.
Yes, we agreed to it. I was out in front of my membership. I was too far out in front of my membership. I was pulled back, and this is where we are today.
Finding any historical information about the Tuskegee Airmen's visits to Tallahassee is hard, but their trips to the city's Dale Mabry Field during World War II live on in local memory.
They trained there, and I had several friends who were in the Tuskegee Airmen. I had the opportunity to go out there and look at them when they would come in and practice.
And the lady who was the first to successfully make that long swim between Cuba and Florida has now brought that historic accomplishment to the stage.
If you want to get through it, you'll find a way to get through it. And I think that is really the message of this play.
A group of Florida lawmakers is looking into the mental health issues of inmates in the state's criminal justice system, as we hear from Sasha Cordner.
For Pinellas Sheriff Bob Gualtieri, he says it's important all law enforcement agencies get some type of training to account for people with mental health issues called Crisis Intervention Team or CIT training.
So you got 27 sheriff's offices that aren't doing CIT at all. I think we need 100%.
He says in the spring of last year, there was a situation that may have been avoided if the deputies had had the proper training.
Because we had a deputy that responded to a mental health call. And as he was taking her into custody under the Baker Act, she lashed out at him, she fought, she kicked him. This deputy was not CIT trained. There were no CIT trained deputies on scene and no supervisors on scene that recognized that what this really was a woman who had serious mental and behavioral health issues, who didn't need to go to the jail, didn't belong in the criminal justice system, but she created the ultimate crime of battery on a law enforcement officer, and if you do that, by God, you go to jail.
But when the woman was jailed, Gualtieri says a series of unfortunate events occurred that led to her dying in the jail, and he had to pay her husband $1.2 million. Still, he says there are areas where there are situations that have gone right because deputies have had the proper training, and he wants to see that type of training done across the state. Gualtieri says that's part of a bill authored by Republican Representative Kathleen Peters.
And it would be a pilot program for $800,000, funded over 3 years, and housed at the Florida Sheriff's Association, that would have a goal of 100% participation for all of the 67 sheriffs in Florida, and also for the hundreds of police departments that don't participate in CIT training to expand it to them as well. There are three main components to the traditional CIT training: law enforcement, mental and behavioral health professionals, and also consumers and advocates.
In Miami-Dade County Circuit Judge Steve Leifman says how to deal with people with mental issues in the court is also an issue. He's also the chairman of the Florida Supreme Court Task Force on Substance Abuse and Mental Health Issues in the Court. And speaking to House Judiciary Committee members Wednesday, he says he's doing a lot of work around the country to educate people about mental health issues in the criminal justice system.
And if you think about it, what we did is we created a system for people that aren't sick. And this is not a 9-to-5 disease. You know, if we treated people with primary health issues the way we treated people with mental illnesses in this country, there would be lawsuits and criminal indictments. It still stuns me that it's okay to discharge people with serious mental illnesses into homelessness. And that's basically what we do.
And Leifman says there are definitely things that are working in his community, like CIT training for thousands of officers.
We created this incredible system of care that focuses on both pre-arrest and post-arrest diversion. We now, in Miami-Dade, have over 4,400 law enforcement officers trained in crisis intervention team policing. In 2013, my two big agencies, I have 36, Miami, the City of Miami and Miami-Dade, handled 10,626 mental health calls, which in and of itself is interesting, but significantly, they only made 9 arrests out of that many calls.
Leifman says in doing that, they've already closed one of the Miami jails, significantly reduced police injuries, and decreased the number of shootings of people with mental illnesses. Meanwhile, the discussion into mental health and substance abuse issues is expected to continue during the first week of the Florida legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Regan McCarthy reports gaming legislation moves several spaces forward this week, with one bill just a few steps away from a win.
Greyhounds are taking the lead, with an injury reporting bill already rounding the corner. It's one of the first bills Senate President Andy Gardner has said he wants to see cross the finish line this session. The measure requires the Department of Business and Professional Regulation to track injuries greyhounds sustain while racing. Officials say a racing greyhound dies in Florida every 3 days. But Jack Corey, who represents the Florida Greyhound Association, says the bill won't help.
We know what's causing these deaths, and we know what's causing the injuries. Therefore, I would ask you and every animal lover to support Senator Smith's Bill 262, which will stop the majority of the injuries, stop the deaths, with a three-point safety plan.
Smith, a Fort Lauderdale Democrat, is sponsoring a bill that would require the Department of Business and Professional Regulation to revoke paramutual permits from any tracks found guilty of animal cruelty. That's different from Hollywood Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel's bill, which gives the DPPR the option of investigating any violations. But Kate McFall from the U.S. Humane Society says increasing transparency through measures like Sobel's injury reporting bill has been proven to reduce greyhound deaths.
When this bill passed in Massachusetts, 43% fewer dogs died. That's almost half. So that's huge. It will save a lot of lives. And it will highlight or shine the light on the number of dogs that are injured. We know they're injured. I know that they're being injured. I've taken dogs off the track with loads of injuries.
McFall says when people start looking at the industry more closely, it causes a change in the way industry officials make decisions.
The industry is set up to make money off of them. So to pay a really pricey vet bill, which it is pricey because I've taken dogs with broken legs and it is pricey, there's no money, so they would just be put down. So if people are looking, I don't know that it's even conscious. People are looking and paying attention, and these numbers are having to be reported. There are fewer that go down.
McFall says her organization is hoping for a measure that would decouple greyhound racing and card rooms for paramutual facilities. In other words, they're hoping to get rid of a rule requiring paramutuals to hold a certain number of races in order to continue offering other kinds of gaming, such as card rooms. It's a move a group of bipartisan lawmakers has been pushing, but so far no such legislation has been filed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
There are more than 400 local pension plans paid for by cities and counties in Florida, and many of them are underwater. The problem has gotten increasingly worse during the past 15 years, with the system's more than $10 billion in the red. Last year, lawmakers thought they had a deal to fix the system, but as Lynn Hatter reports, the cities are backing away from it.
Local pension plans are usually reserved for city employees, police, and firefighters. The police and firefighter systems are in the most trouble. According to a 2014 Lowry Collins Institute study, about a third of the local pension plans it considered are underwater. The Institute's Carol Weissert says part of the problem is due to a 1999 law that changed the way tax revenue on insurance premiums can be used. The change resulted in the revenue going toward additional benefits, not base obligations. And Weissert says that's a big cause of the current deficits in local plans.
In recent years, when it's become clear that a number of the plans are in poor financial shape, it didn't seem to make any sense that the only way you used those dollars was to provide new benefits.
Lawmakers came up with a solution last year to fix the problem, but it was tied to a state pension plan overhaul and it failed. This year, the bills are separate, and Senate President Andy Gardner says he's far more inclined to support the local pension plan overhaul.
Actually, Senator Bradley had legislation last year that passed unanimously out of the Senate. The House has indicated that they're going to split those two issues before they were combined into one. So we hope we can address the local pension issue.
Senator Rob Bradley is back with the exact same bill he filed last year to fix local pensions. It's a compromise between the cities and the police and firefighter unions, or rather it was. Florida League of Cities lobbyist Craig Kahn says he spoke too soon in supporting last year's deal.
Yes, we agreed to it. I was out in front of my membership. I was too far out in front of my membership. I was pulled back, and this is where we are today.
Cities are backing away from the legislation over concerns it's too generous to the unions. Police Benevolent Association lobbyist Matt Puckett says the cities don't want to bargain with the unions. Collective bargaining, as it's called, stays in place under Bradley's bill.
It's a good compromise. I'm surprised that they called it a compromise. They testified in the last committee that it wasn't a compromise, that it was a giveaway. It's good legislation.
The cities prefer what's called the Naples letter. It's a state opinion which has allowed some municipalities to use the tax money to cover current obligations and, if something is left over, fund extra benefits. FSU's Carol Weissert says cities prefer the Naples interpretation because it gives them more flexibility.
The cities really are worried about the financial viability of these plans, and to be able to use some substantial amount of those premium tax dollars to provide for the benefits they've already committed to seems to make a lot of sense to them.
But a deal is a deal, and lawmakers have been chiding the cities over what some view as hypocrisy for backing away from a deal cities initially supported. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Here's a question for you. How hard is it to locate more than 1,700 acres of history in Tallahassee? Well, you might think it would be a breeze, but as D.A. Robin recently found, it's a tough task when what you're looking for is the old Dale Mabry Airfield.
Information about Dale Mabry Field is sparse and scattered across Florida's capital. There are, of course, the biographical details everyone who knows about the city's first airport seems to know. It was built in 1929 and named for a local pilot who died in a crash earlier that decade. And at the start of World War II, the government extended and converted Dale Mabry Field to support the war.
Dale Mabry Field is part of a network, hundreds, really over 1,000, often that are temporary air bases for World War II to train pilots.
Kurt Peeler is a historian who runs Florida State University's Institute on World War II and the Human Experience. Peeler says the field helped train thousands of pilots. In fact, in 1942, some of the famed African-American pilot corps, the Tuskegee Airmen, trained in advanced gunnery at Dale Mabry Field. James Ford, the city's first African-American mayor, remembers being inspired as a young man by the airmen's visits to Tallahassee. He spoke to WFSU-TV in 2007 for the Florida War Diaries project.
They trained there, and I had several friends who were in the Tuskegee Airmen. I had the opportunity to go out there and look at them when they would come in and practice.
But they weren't greeted well when they got here, says local doctor and Tuskegee Airmen expert Alan Brickler.
This was not probably one of our better moments in history. When they came here and landed at Dale Mabry Field, they were placed in prison barracks rather than given equal station according to their rank.
Here's where the record gets thin. Florida's Heritage Trail website devotes exactly one sentence to the airmen's training in Tallahassee. Local historians disagree on how long they stayed. Brickler cites the memoirs of Colonel Benjamin O. Davis, who commanded the airmen, as his source for their experience in Florida's capital. Brickler says he believes the airmen received slightly better treatment on later trips to Tallahassee.
They did make it, you know, more than one time, and presumably their experiences were not as horrendous from that point on. But they did recognize that that was an unpleasant set of circumstances.
And FSU's Peeler says the fight for recognition of the Tuskegee Airmen was as much about self-determination as it was about winning the war. He says many in the military establishment wanted them to fail.
Looking at the Tuskegee Airmen, why the Tuskegee Airmen come into being, part of it is a need for manpower. But also, the military was quite stubborn at times about recognizing the importance of African Americans to the war effort.
Former Tallahassee Mayor James Ford says African Americans shared in the airmen's triumphs and strove for greater successes after these first black men took flight.
There was a certain amount of pride. It was a black frying group, and there just was nothing like that. It was an unheard of thing for a black to aspire to be.
A historical marker stands outside Tallahassee Community College off West Pensacola Street, where the airfield's runway ended. It holds probably the last of the memory of that portion of history that has been buried under the buildings that now make up TCC. Legend tells of a 40s-era building that might have housed the airmen, but where it is exactly, no one seems to know. For Florida Public Radio, I'm D.A. Robin.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. The Florida Department of Juvenile Justice is looking into the death this week of a young man held at Brevard Regional Juvenile Detention Facility. An email from the department gave few details of the incident, other than saying the detainee was found unresponsive at the facility early Thursday afternoon. A nurse performed CPR, but the detainee was declared dead at the medical center in Rockledge later in the day. Local law enforcement led the initial investigation. The Florida DJJ is also conducting its own probe. The statement didn't provide the age of the detainee, only describing him as a young man. Finally this week, marathon swimmer Diana Nyad, remember her? She's staging a theatrical presentation this week about her 111-mile swim from Cuba to Key West on the island where she completed the nearly impossible athletic feat. Onward, the Diana Nyad story opened last night at the studios of Key West near the spot where she achieved her dream of 35 years. On Labor Day 2013, an exhausted Nyad walked ashore on Key West Smathers Beach, becoming the first person to swim across the Florida Straits from Cuba to the Florida Keys without a shark cage. The swim took the world-renowned athlete, then 64 years old, nearly 53 hours.
A 35-year story, a 64-year-old chasing a dream that no one's else ever accomplished. A combination of a bit of a life story that informs who is that person who was brave enough to try that thing and keep trying that thing.
Nyad initially attempted the Florida Straits crossing in 1978 when she was 28 years old. More than three decades later, in 2011 and 2012, she tried three times but was foiled by shoulder pain, a debilitating in-water asthma attack, and multiple severe jellyfish stings.
We're out to the Bahamas again. We have 100 more hours to go. And she says, no, listen to me. Face over this way. Use your hands, feather a little bit, get up on top of the water. Tell me what you see.
Written and performed live by Nyad, Onward showcases not only her athletic feat, but also her storytelling abilities and wry humor. In addition, the inspirational play spotlights the tenacity and strength that helped her achieve her long-held dream in 2013.
I don't care whether you're someone up against cancer, or you have a disabled child you're raising. So in really tough circumstances, if you want to get through it, you'll find a way to get through it. And I think that is really the message of this play.
The show employs audio and visual effects to take audiences to the Florida Straits with Nyad as she endures a nighttime encounter with jellyfish. She also shares family and childhood memories, sings snippets of the mental playlist that kept her going during the crossing, and even swims on stage. The production was directed and adapted for the stage by Josh Ravetch, the co-creator of Carrie Fisher's Wishful Drinking. Key West performances continue through this Sunday. Following each show, spectators can take part in a question-and-answer session with Nyad. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Matthew Seeger. We also thank D.A. Robin and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.